Welcome to the Science Signaling Podcast for November 24th, 2009. I'm Annalisa Van Hook. In this episode, I'm speaking to Tony Pawson about a paper from his group published in the current issue of Science Signaling about the evolution of new combinations of protein domains. Proteins are composed of functional units called domains. Domains perform specific biochemical activities or mediate interactions with specific binding partners. These domains are modular, and a protein's biological function is determined by the type, the number, and even the arrangement of the domains that it contains. In fact, domain shuffling is one of the major ways by which evolutionary change occurs at the molecular level. Genetic rearrangements may generate new combinations of domains, which in turn give rise to proteins that have new biological functions. Genetic mutations can also alter the binding specificity or the biochemical activity of a domain. These two types of genetic change together are capable of generating great variation in protein activity, variation which can then be acted on by natural selection. If a new combination of domains produces a protein that is useful to the organism, then it undergoes positive selection and it's passed on to future generations. In a paper published this week in Science Signaling, Jin and co-workers have surveyed the complete proteomes, that is, all of the proteins, for several eukaryotic species to identify how particular combinations of domains correlate with evolutionary change. Tony Pawson was the senior author on that paper, and he spoke to me on the phone from his office at the Mount Sinai Hospital in Toronto. First, I would just like to say welcome, Dr. Pawson.
Thanks.
In this project, you looked at the domain architecture represented in several species' proteomes. How many protein domains did you include in your analysis, and how many proteomes did you look at?
So we looked at seven proteomes, starting with yeast as a simple eukaryote, and then Dictyostelium, the amoeba, worms, flies, fish, chickens, and humans. So seven proteomes that span a range of eukaryotic evolution. And then in terms of the number of domains, we looked, for most part, 623 domains, which is in the SMART database, and the reason for doing that is that they're particularly well annotated, and we have very good ideas about what they do and their structure and function.
By casting such a wide net, by looking at such a range of species, what were you hoping to learn about domain architecture and how that changes over evolutionary time?
Well, we wanted to know, firstly, if we took all of those proteomes and combined them into one, what sorts of domain combinations would we see? And then go back and ask, as you're alluding to, how those change from one species to another, particularly as species become more complex. And in particular, we wanted to know, are there domains that seem to acquire new functions and enter new combinations of domains that might represent an evolutionary jump and the appearance of a new biological function? Or might there be other domains that disappear, or would there be domains that sort of simply become sort of slowly, incrementally more complex in terms of the other domains that they're associated with? And all of those sorts of things we found.
To ask questions about the evolution of protein domain architecture, you categorize proteins into what in the paper you call domain clubs. What were your criteria for defining a club, and how many clubs did you come up with?
So we're looking for, as you say, for proteins that share domain compositions, in fact. So we didn't look at the architecture in the sense of sort of which domain comes after which domain. We're just interested in aggregate what domain composition each protein had. Okay. And we did that using initially a sort of matrix format where we ask, firstly, if you take all of the proteins in all of those seven species and you ask, sort of on one axis, if you will, what domains are found in what proteins, and then you ask on the other axis what proteins contain what domains, and then subject that to a hierarchical clustering, you end up with groups that are related because they represent proteins that share a common set of domains, or conversely, domains that are found in a common set of proteins. And we called that a domain club, and that was a name that the first author, Jing Jin, came up with. And in terms of how many clubs there are, that's somewhat arbitrary in the sense that, you know, at the end of the day, each protein could be a separate club.
Right. It depends on how fine you choose to make the divisions between the clubs.
So we had to draw a line somewhere. So we separated proteins into around 1,200 clubs based on a sort of jump in the distribution of the clubs. But we showed that if we sort of moved the cutoff point, that didn't affect any of our conclusions. So we identified, in a sense, 1,200 or so clubs, but that's a somewhat arbitrary definition to give us something to work with.
Were there clubs that were composed entirely of proteins only found in more complex organisms? And then some domain clubs that had proteins from yeast and from fly and from humans?
Yeah, exactly. So there are some clubs that are highly conserved. And in fact, we separate the clubs into two groups. The majority of domain clubs represent proteins, each of which has multiple domains linked covalently. There's a separate group of clubs that only ever have one domain, and they tend to be very highly conserved, so sort of actin as an example, or actin-related proteins. So they tend to be very highly conserved. But as you say, there are domain clubs which are very highly conserved. There are domain clubs that you find only in yeast, and then they die out, presumably because they serve a specific function of yeast, like making the cell wall that, you know, animal cells don't use. And then there are domains that appear, and certainly domain clubs that appear, as multicellular animals emerge and things become more complex, particularly involved in signal transduction and cellular communication.
Domains not only get shuffled relative to one another, so you get new combinations of domains as proteins evolve, but domains can also undergo mutation that changes their binding properties or it changes their biochemical activity. When a domain undergoes some sort of genetic change, is that altered version of the domain more likely to become associated with a different type of domain than, it, say, its parental version was?
So that's sort of really the key question, and the answer is yes. And in figure 4 of the paper, we use SH2 domains, which is a domain that we've worked on for a long time, as an example. So in yeast, there is something that looks like an SH2 domain, but it has no phosphotyrosine binding activity, that being the normal function of the SH2 domains of multicellular animals. Rather, it's part of a protein that's involved in controlling gene expression, and it's very highly conserved. It's present in a single protein, and that protein is conserved from yeast to humans. Somewhere in between yeast and Dictyostelium or Monosiga, SH2 domains acquired the ability to bind phosphotyrosine. And concomitant with that new binding activity, they jump, as we would call it, in the tree of domain clubs into an entirely new environment where they're linked to new domains, you know, SH3 domains, kinase domains, and so forth. So that, we think, is a critical behavior that might mark jumps in evolution, that a domain is duplicated, acquires a new binding property or a new enzymatic activity, and then becomes linked to domains to which it was not previously joined. And that gives it access to a whole new realm of cellular behavior. And that's one of our arguments as to how one gets a jump in the complexity of organisms that, as you say, domains acquire new functions and become linked to entirely new sets of domains that put them into a new sort of environment, if you will, within the cell.
So a genetic change that alters the binding properties or the biochemical activity of a domain might then just be opening the door for that domain to be used in more and more different ways.
Exactly. And so it's sort of a combination of the new property of the domain and the novel domains that it then becomes associated with that can kind of create a new environment and a new signaling function or a new biological activity.
Did you note any trends for particular combinations of domains to be associated with particular biological processes or to be associated with a particular cell structure?
Yes, we did. This was sort of quite a complex analysis, so I won't go through the details. But the idea was that particular aspects of biological function, like signal transduction, you know, growth factor signaling, or apoptosis and inflammation, or chromatin organization, that they might use particular sets of domains. So we set out to test that hypothesis, and basically what we asked was, if we looked at particular proteins that contain particular domains, and we looked at all of the proteins and all of the domains with which they interacted or reportedly interact with, and then analyze those data mathematically, was there a relationship such that domain A and domain B tend to associate with particular sets of proteins that domain X and domain Y don't? And the data were quite clear and were sort of intuitive, but this has never been done in a rigorous way. So there are a set of domains that are used in growth factor signaling, but are not used for, let's say, in apoptosis and inflammation. There are a set of domains that are used in apoptosis and inflammation that aren't used in growth factor signaling. There's a set of domains that are used in chromatin organization that are rather specific to that particular aspect of cellular function. There are a set of domains that are used in trafficking and protein and vesicle trafficking. So the argument is, as you say, in which we think we've shown in a fairly rigorous way, that particular aspects of cellular function utilize particular domains, and there may not be anything particularly special about those domains other than that they're the sort of molecular currency that particular part of the cell, if you will, employs. There are, of course, domains that are very widely used in many different aspects of cellular function, so it's not completely black and white.
What about domains of unknown function? Did you include any domains in your analysis that have ambiguous or unidentified function? And then were you able to...
We did, yes. So we then expanded on that analysis that I was discussing and asked, let's say, the proteins that have domains that are involved in growth factor signaling or apoptosis or chromatin reorganization, do they contain any domains that have unknown functions? And there's a set of domains that are rather charmingly called DUFs, for domains of unknown function. And we found several such DUFs, or domains of unknown function, that were linked to domains that are involved in particular cellular properties. So we would predict that they're involved in those particular aspects of cellular function, though we haven't yet tested that. One thing we did test, we went on to look at a set of domains called CUDA domains that bind to typically to methylated arginines or lysines. And we argued that we could trace an increasing complexity of CUDA domains, and we identified a set of CUDA domains that we referred to as germline CUDA domains, because they're found in specifically in germ cells. And we predicted and then showed that what those germline CUDA domains do is to interact with methylated arginines on PIWI proteins, which are the argonaut counterparts in the germline that process the PI RNAs. So from this purely sort of domain-based bioinformatic analysis, we made a prediction that we and then, well, not then as well, many others have recently published, as well as ourselves, that these germline CUDAs sort of interact with these PIWI proteins. So, that was sort of a nice example of using this analysis of domain evolution to predict a function for a particular domain.
In terms of the big picture of protein evolution, what does this sort of analysis teach you about how complexity arises in proteins, how domains are combined and recombined to generate the vast complexity of proteins that we see in complex organisms like humans?
Well, I think the reason that we're particularly interested in it is that, as you know, the number of genes between simple organisms like yeast and what we think of as much more complex organisms like ourselves, the number of genes only changes a few fold, so complexity must reside in some other property, and clearly one very important aspect of complexity is the varied expression of genes and things like alternative splicing. But that by itself is probably not the whole answer. I mean, rather what this sort of analysis tells us, and I must say there's been a lot of beautiful work done by the bioinformatics community over the years that argues that as organisms become more complex, corresponding proteins themselves become more complex because they acquire new domains and enter into new domain combinations and can, in fact, as we were discussing earlier, domains can completely jump into new environments when their biochemical properties change by linking up to new sets of domains. So that, we think, is a, or our data would argue, is a really critical aspect of evolution, that proteins, rather than making new genes to make new proteins, that the proteins acquire new functions and new connections by acquiring new sets of domains. And we argue that the cell sort of has a set of kind of environments, if you will, microenvironments that are patterned by particular domains and domain combinations, and that there's a dynamic interaction between proteins and their environment that involves these domain sets. So you can think of it as sort of, you know, evolution on a sort of micro scale. So we think that this is a particularly important aspect of how cells and organisms have become more complex. Rather than inventing new ways of doing things every time you need a new function, it's been much more easy to join existing domains together in new ways, perhaps at the same time tweaking them to give new functions, so that evolution by and large has progressed not so much by inventing new domains as joining them in new ways and giving them new activities. When a domain moves out of its sort of ancestral environment and occupies some new space in the cell, then it itself can then pattern sort of a new microenvironment, so that this sort of constant back and forth between domains can really create sort of amazing new structures, which then lends itself to this whole, you know, idea of synthetic biology. So if that's what's happened in the course of evolution, can we create new proteins, new ways of doing biology? You know, so for example, there's a beautiful experiment done by Klaus Hahn, published recently, where he joined a domain from a plant, rather charmingly called a love domain, that is sensitive to light, to the RAC GTPase, and showed that that chimeric protein is now sensitive to light, so he can actually turn on the RAC GTPase at will just by shining a laser at the right spot in the cell. So things are now really just sort of limited by your imagination, you know, in terms of sort of joining, giving domains new functions, and you know, we're not restricted to animals. We can join plant domains and human domains and get proteins with new functions, and as I said, in this particular case, make human proteins light sensitive. So this whole area of synthetic biology really depends a lot on this idea that evolution has in part preceded by the joining of domains in new ways, and we can clearly do the same thing.
Dr. Pawson, thank you for speaking with me.
My pleasure.
That was Tony Pawson discussing a paper from his group published in today's issue of Science Signaling. That paper is titled Eukaryotic Protein Domains as Functional Units of Cellular Evolution. That wraps up this Science Signaling podcast. If you have any questions or suggestions, please write to us at sciencesignalingeditors@aaas.org. This show is a production of Science Signaling and of AAAS, Advancing Science, Serving Society. I'm Annalisa Van Hook, and on behalf of Science Signaling and its publisher, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, thanks for listening.